Hello, and thank you for joining us on this Urology Times Medcast series on exploring recent developments in the treatment of prostate cancer. This episode is entitled Expanding Options in Metastatic Hormone-Sensitive Prostate Cancer: What the Latest FDA Approval Means for Clinical Practice. I'm Dr. Jack Andrews. I'm a urologic oncologist and surgeon scientist at Mayo Clinic, Arizona in Phoenix.
Hi, I'm Alicia Morgans. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and a GU medical oncologist, as well as being the director of the Adult Survivorship Program at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston.
Thanks for joining us, Dr. Morgans. A recent FDA approval has expanded treatment options for patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. This is prompting new questions about sequencing, tolerability, and then really real-world decision-making. So in this episode, we're going to explore how clinicians are navigating these changes, how patient characteristics and emerging trial designs may influence your therapy choice. Faculty will weigh in on interpreting surrogate endpoints, applying data from older trials and older and more comorbid patients, the evolving role of real-world evidence. So tune in for our practical discussion on the intersection of data and day-to-day care. Joining us in this conversation today is one of my partners, Dr. Urbaz Riaz. He specializes in genital urinary cancers, including prostate cancer, kidney cancer, bladder, and testicular cancer at Mayo Clinic, Arizona. Dr. Riaz also holds a doctorate in clinical and translational science and a master's degree in biomedical informatics. So thanks for joining us, Dr. Riaz, and thank you all for joining us today. Let's begin.
All right, great. So let's discuss this recent milestone in the treatment landscape of metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. So at this point in time, after this advance, darolutamide can be used in combination with ADT, either with docetaxel in a triplet sort of an approach, or without, just as a doublet combination, ADT and darolutamide. I wonder if we can kind of walk through the clinical basis and whether this you find this to be significant in your practice. And Urbaz, I wonder if you can start us off.
Oh, thank you. So glad to be here. Let's first set the stage of where we are in the treatment landscape, and then we move to darolutamide. The current standard of care for metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer is androgen biosynthesis inhibitor or receptor pathway inhibitor, ARPIs plus NADT, with or without docetaxel. Prior to darolutamide's approval in this setting, our options were abiraterone with prednisone, biosynthesis inhibitor or ARPIs, enzalutamide or apalutamide. Now, with darolutamide's FDA approval, we have a fourth option. So this is quite an exciting development for our patients. The approval is built on robust clinical evidence from two pivotal phase three trials, ARISEN and ARANOTE. ARISEN's trial was a practice-changing trial because it showed that darolutamide plus ADT and docetaxel significantly improved overall survival, 32.5% reduction in the risk of death compared to placebo, quite clinically meaningful. In ARANOTE, we saw a 46% reduction in the risk of radiographic progression or death. That's a hazard ratio of 0.54. I want to be balanced and transparent here. While we saw this impressive progression-free survival benefit, overall survival benefit wasn't statistically significant in ARANOTE. But it's important to remember that OS wasn't the primary endpoint, and the data is not mature yet. ARANOTE results, I think, fill a crucial gap in our treatment landscape. The trial specifically looked at darolutamide plus ADT without chemotherapy. And this is so important because not every patient needs docetaxel or is a good candidate for docetaxel, whether due to age, comorbidities, or patient preference. What's particularly compelling here is, I think, what was presented as quality of life data at ASCO 2025. Darolutamide was the first and only AR inhibitor to demonstrate clinically meaningful delays in both pain progression and deterioration in overall well-being, including social and family well-being, functional well-being, and even urinary symptoms. The significance of this approval is multifaceted. Clinically, we now have the flexibility to offer darolutamide to MCSPC patients, whether they're getting docetaxel or not. This is crucial because, frankly, we know that ADT monotherapy is still being used way too frequently in the real world. The data suggests that even up to 30% of MCSPC patients or MHSPC patients receive ADT alone, often due to concerns about tolerability or drug accessibility. And now we have fourth option, and we'll talk more about how we can go between these drugs.
Yeah, so you brought up a lot of really good points, and one being, not everybody needs triplet therapy, and there are some patients that are right for doublet therapy. And when it comes to the androgen receptor inhibitors, when we talked about some of the drugs that you mentioned, enzalutamide, apalutamide, and now darolutamide, we kind of basket them together as the same type of drug, but there are differences in how they mechanistically work in the body and how tolerable they are. Can you describe a little bit of those differences that darolutamide might exhibit compared to other AR pathway inhibitors?
Great question. So abiraterone blocks androgen biosynthesis in multiple tissues, testes, adrenal, and prostate, whereas apalutamide, enzalutamide, and darolutamide, they block the receptor itself. And the way it works is it blocks the drug from, it blocks the testosterone and its metabolites to get to the receptor, blocks the receptor from moving into the nucleus, prevent it from binding to the DNA. So really, testosterone cannot really act in the presence of androgen pathway inhibitors like darolutamide, apalutamide, and enzalutamide. The key difference with other RPs from daro is daro is structurally distinct. The key structural difference is that daro has a much more rigid molecule structure compared to enzalutamide and apalutamide. The rigid structure is what gives it very low blood-brain barrier penetration. Essentially, it is too bulky to easily cross into the brain. This is in contrast to enzalutamide, for example, which has much better CNS penetration, and hence you have more CNS symptoms. Another key difference is more pharmacologic, drug-drug interactions. Darolutamide has minimal potential for drug-drug interactions as compared to, other candidates here, apalutamide and abiraterone, which is particularly relevant for older patients were often on multiple medications for comorbidities. When we look at the safety profile of darolutamide from ARANOTE, we saw that adverse events were literally similar as compared to the placebo group, 90% approximately in both arms. But what was really telling was fewer patients discontinued darolutamide. So fewer patients discontinued if they were on two drugs, right? Impressive. And the patients in the darolutamide arm rate of discontinuation was 6.1% compared to 9% in the placebo arm. Another thing that we saw was quite remarkable was the incidence of fatigue. Darolutamide had lower incidence of fatigue compared to placebo. Let me repeat that. Lower incidence of fatigue compared to placebo. 5.6% to darolutamide versus 8.1% of placebo. That's a 30% relative risk reduction compared to the control group. This is completely different from what we saw with enzalutamide and apalutamide, where fatigue rates were typically much higher, around 24% with enzalutamide in ARCHES, or 20% in apalutamide in TITAN. So mechanistically and clinically, darolutamide offered us a distinct option with potentially better tolerability, especially for patients where fatigue or cognitive effects might be potentially concerning.
Yeah, so thank you so much for running us through the numbers. And I think it's really interesting, the way that the clinical trials do try to characterize what are patients experiencing. But they are really characterizing that based on what the clinicians and the other research team members are assessing as they're doing those clinical trial evaluations when patients are coming in. One of the things that I think is so important, though, too, is the way that our patients in our own practices seem to feel on these drugs. And I wonder, in your practice, how do your patients do when they're on darolutamide? And we all use all of these agents for various reasons. So I'm sure you have some experiences with other agents. Is there any difference in the way patients seem to feel or to say that they experience this drug as compared to others?
This is a good question, and it comes up all the time, right? But I want to start by, acknowledging a really important point that you made. It's really hard to ascertain or attribute toxicities to RPs in the clinical trials. The backbone of side effects, really hot flashes, weight gain, brain fog, sexual dysfunction, they're primarily driven by ADT. And when you have an RP on top of it's really hard to know what is causing what. So the real life experiences become critical. I think there's several actually experiences in the last month or so that I can talk about to give a sense of how I'm, thinking about darolutamide and how I'm talking to patients about them and how what I'm hearing from them. I recently had a patient who was experiencing significant brain fog on enzalutamide. You know, the patient was almost ready to quit. And we talked to this, and now with darolutamide's approval, we switched the patient to darolutamide. You know, remarkably, you know, there was a significant difference in how patient felt on, you know, getting on darolutamide. This makes perfect sense given darolutamide's low CNS penetration profile. Another example where a patient was ready to discontinue abiraterone because of significant fatigue. Again, switching to darolutamide helped significantly with the fatigue burden. This again aligns with the clinical trial data we discussed, the remarkable finding of lower fatigue incidence with darolutamide. But here's what's really important to understand. It can also work the other way around too. I had a patient who was on darolutamide who was experiencing constant dizziness, not something you would typically think about with darolutamide, but it was really bothering the patient. I really want him to be on doublet therapy, so I switched to apalutamide. The dizziness resolved quite significantly. So what this teaches me or us in sort of these experiences is that our patients have very individualized responses to these medicines, you know, and having different RPs option available is really a luxury that allows us to optimize therapy for each patient's unique situation. The key here is listening to our patients, recognizing when side effects are impacting their quality of life, and knowing that, you know, we can switch and an alternative agent might work. And now we can keep our patients on doublet therapy, ADT plus, you know, NRP or androgen biosynthesis inhibitor. And that's why I think the addition of darolutamide is really helpful. It gives another tool to personalize the treatment options so that we can optimize both the efficacy and the tolerability in our patients.
Yeah, thanks for that, Urbaz. And I am really excited to see what the kind of community's response is when they have more experience with darolutamide in their patients and what they're finding that works and what are the right patients for darolutamide. And I think you did a really good summary of kind of what's going on mechanistically and why we saw potentially better tolerability in these trials. So a question I would have for you is, now we have multiple AR pathway inhibitors available to us and you're seeing patients, what affects your treatment decision? And, you know, we talked about some of the tolerability, we talked about the ability to switch, you know, we're all doing this in the absence of head-to-head comparisons. And so how do you face that barrier of you don't have a head-to-head comparison, but we try and look at these trials and compare what the side effects were, and how do you use that to counsel your patients?
Yeah. This is one of the most practical questions we face daily, right? And you're absolutely right. The absence of head-to-head trials makes definite treatment decisions more challenging. And Jack, you know that we work together on our living network meta-analysis, and we try to tease out the differences between these agents, and frankly, it's hard to find any meaningful statistical differences in terms of efficacy outcomes. So in the absence of clear efficacy signals, all of them work very well, I've shifted my approach to think more about the reasons why I would avoid a particular RP in a specific patient rather than trying to pick the best one universally. Here's how I typically think about it. For enzalutamide, I tend to avoid this in patients where CNS issues would be particularly problematic. History of seizures, obviously, is a no-no. Brain fog, cognitive impairment, fatigue. When a patient is coming with this baseline, I tend to avoid enzalutamide. Similarly, you think about apalutamide, for instance, you know, rash is something, you know, fracture risk is another thing where, you know, I tend to think about avoiding apalutamide. Abiraterone naturally requires co-administration with prednisone. I avoid it in patients with, you know, glucose intolerance issues, uncontrolled hypertension, and those who want to avoid chronic steroid exposure. Conversely, it might be a better choice if somebody needs a bit of steroids, like with rheumatologic issues. And darolutamide, honestly, with the new data we have, I've started to prefer it in many situations. The reasons are quite compelling. We have documented lower fatigue rates, lower discontinuation rates due to adverse events. And now with Aronaut's quality of life data, we have documented improved quality of life outcomes. The minimal drug-drug interactions also make it more attractive for our older, more complex patients. As I mentioned in my earlier clinical examples, individual responses to patients can vary, and sometimes you need to be willing to switch between agents based on how patients tolerate them. The real luxury is really having four options, which allow us to personalize treatment. If one patient doesn't tolerate one agent as well, we have alternatives. This is a much better position than we are in now as compared to a few years ago.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's always nice to have options. And I think as we continue to acquire data and we look at meta-analyses and other compilations of some of these data, one of the things that has kind of come to light is that there may be differences, whether they're in effectiveness, particularly when it comes to survival, or perhaps in toxicity as well, for some of the agents over others. And one in particular, I think abiraterone has been called out in one of the meta-analyses, the stopcap analysis. I wonder, are there specific things that you think about in patients who are over 75? And of course, we remember that sometimes more complex patients with more comorbidities are not even going to be in some of the trials that we have, so they can't necessarily inform the data. But certainly you can use your clinical experience and then some of these network meta-analyses to try to draw some conclusions as well.
Yeah, I think this is obviously a very practical question. The average age of patients in most of these trials range between 65 and 70 years old. Plus, I mean, let me say that ARANOT actually did a pretty good job of including older adults. The median age was 70, and importantly, they included patients up to 93 years old. About 27%, I think, of the patients were 75 years or older, which is better representation than we often see in oncology trials. But you're absolutely right that patients with significant comorbidities are often underrepresented. While I'm considering treatments for my older, more complex patients, I think about several key factors. Tolerability becomes even more important. These patients have lower physiological reserve to side effects as compared to obviously younger, healthier patients. And that's where, for example, I'm more, compelled to use darolutamide because we saw that, in ARANOT with reasonable representation of older adults, the drug was tolerated quite well. Lower fatigue rate, minimal CNS effects, reduced drug-drug interactions, especially valuable in this population. And polypharmacy is the norm in this population, right? And again, they have multiple meds for cardiovascular disease, diabetes, hypertension, you name it. Darolutamide, minimal drug-drug interaction profile also shines here. Goals of care conversations become critical. For some of these patients, maintaining quality of life and functional independence may be more important than maximizing survival benefit. And this is, again, I'm sounding like a rep to sell darolutamide here, but the quality of life data from ARANOT showing delays in pain progression and preservation of functional well-being becomes really relevant in these discussions. Now, I can tell patient that I would like to put you on two drugs, in a patient who doesn't need docetaxel, the optimal treatment. And the expectation is that you're not going to have any additional side effects. So another key aspect in these patients, older patients, is start low, go slow. Don't automatically assume they can tolerate treatment. A lot of my patients are, and a lot of all of our patients are older adults with 70s, 75s, even 80s. And in our practice, we see that they do reasonably well on, darolutamide and other RPs as well. And I think the key is monitoring them closely. These patients may need more frequent assessments, especially early in the treatment, to catch any issues before before they become problematic. And the key is individualizing the approach. If the patient is not doing well on one agent, we switch. And I think that's sort of how I'm thinking about, older adults at the moment.
That was really good, Irbaz. I really appreciate your comments and your experience. I think it's really important to highlight what y'all said is that we have more options now, and darolutamide is one of those options in this space, and that it potentially has better tolerability. It's another option for our patients, particularly men who might be older, more comorbid. It's about finding the right drug for the right patient, but it's also about having that backup option because we can't always predict how patients are going to respond. I want to pivot a little bit, and I'm really glad you're our guest today because working with you, I know you have a ton of open trials, and I know about all your work with the AI models for kind of all the trials that exist in the prostate cancer space. So you know this as well as anybody, and so I want to talk a little bit about trial design and how we interpret data from trials. When you come back from ASCO or GU ASCO, you see all these subgroup analyses that are making the headlines. They're not always quite what they're led to be. So how do you interpret the data to say that's meaningful, or maybe this isn't quite what it's meant to tell us? So how do you challenge that?
Yeah, I hear you. The subgroup analysis can be both incredibly valuable and incredibly misleading. And frankly, they often get misinterpreted in the literature and conferences, right? I want to talk about some key principles, right? The key principle here is that most, if not all subgroup analysis should be viewed as hypothesis generating, not definitive. The main trial is powered for the primary endpoint in the overall population and not for subgroup effects. But yet, subgroup analyses are meaningful. And how do I evaluate subgroup analysis? First, I see whether it was pre-specified. This is crucial, right? Pre-specified subgroup analyses that were planned before the trial are much more credible than post-hoc analysis that were done after looking at the data, right? Second, does it make biological sense? If someone shows me a subgroup analysis suggesting that, you know, abiraterone or darolutamide works better in patients born on Tuesdays, I'm going to be skeptical, right? But if they show a difference based on disease volume or baseline PSA, that is biological plausibility, I will tend to think a little bit more about that. Another key is that look for consistency across studies. We have now several RPE and, you know, abiraterone trials. A subgroup finding that shows up in multiple independent trials is much more credible than something that just appears in one study. I think one of the statistical thing I carefully look at is I examine the statistical interaction test. This is often overlooked, but it's crucial. You want to see a significant p-value for interaction, not just look at whether confidence intervals overlap. Many subgroup claims are made without proper interaction testing. Fifth and lastly, consider the magnitude and clinical relevance. Even if the subgroup difference is statistically significant, is it clinically meaningful? I always sort of keep this framework in mind when I'm trying to sort of look through and think through the subgroup analysis. For example, you know, across, you know, RP trials, and when I say RP, I'm also including abiraterone, we saw consistent benefit across high volume and low volume disease, making it more biologically plausible. And then when we looked at the effect of docetaxel across volume of disease subgroups, you know, there was a significant difference there. So this is how I'm thinking about subgroup analysis with a statistical framework, considering biological plausibility, consistency across different trials. My practical approach, I use subgroup analysis to inform discussions with patients about expected benefit, but I don't make treatment decisions based on subgroup analysis alone, unless they're very robust and replicated. The bottom line is that subgroup analysis can provide valuable insights, but they need to be interpreted with appropriate caution and statistical rigor.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and such good words of caution for us, I think, in general, as we are always trying to interpret new data. And subgroup analyses, it's interesting that, you know, there is always such an emphasis. They make headlines, but more than that, sometimes they can be over relied upon. And your thoughts about informing conversations with patients and informing those sort of discussions around what's most likely, what's most plausible, you know, what happened with other people like you, that makes a lot of sense. Unless, like you said, that they're, you know, robustly designed, a priori, part of the statistical plan, you know, these are different levels of evidence. So that was really, really helpful. So thank you for that. You know, a different part of clinical development is this concept of adaptive trials and basket trials. These are just newer designs that also help us improve flexibility and really try to help expand how quickly we can get drugs forward for our patients. But of course, they have challenges, as anything will. I wonder what your thoughts are on adaptive and basket trials and how these might help in GU oncology in general in the future.
Yeah, good question. This is a fascinating space with evolving clinical trial designs that are particularly relevant in oncology, also in GU oncology. These new trial designs are really trying to address some of the limitations of the traditional randomized trial designs, but they come with their own sets of challenges. Maybe I can start with adaptive trials. The best example in prostate cancer comes from the STEMPEDE platform trial. It's a multi-arm, multi-stage adaptive platform trial that has been running since 2005. The main thing here is that instead of testing one treatment comparison, STEMPEDE was designed as a platform that could evolve over time. It started with ADT versus ADT plus docetaxel, but then adaptively, added new arms, abiraterone, enzalutamide, radiotherapy arms, all using the shared control arm. The beauty of STAMPEDE or adaptive designs is that as new drugs become available or new questions arise, they can add new experimental arms without starting entirely new clinical trials. They have made adaptive decisions along the way, stopping some arms early for futility, like zoledronic acid, while others like docetaxel and abiraterone showed clear benefits and changed practice. This approach has answered multiple practice-changing questions using one infrastructure over nearly two decades. And there are also like more subtle examples of adaptive trials. For instance, you would analyze first in HRR positive population, and if that's positive, then you'll move to the entire population data analysis, making the trials more efficient. Basket trials are, they take a different approach. They test one treatment across multiple cancer types or biomarker-defined populations simultaneously. An example would be studying PARP inhibitors across different types of different cancer types that have BRCA mutations, instead of running separate trials for BRCA-positive prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, breast cancer. You can test the same PARP inhibitor across all three in one master protocol. Designs like this could be, for example, adaptive design could be sort of thought of with newer drugs like HIF-2 inhibitors. This is just the indications are expanding quite rapidly. Because the advantages are compelling. They're more efficient, there's better resource optimization. Obviously, they go in the spirit of precision medicine with the biomarker-driven therapy rather than just histology-driven approaches. And flexibility can stop ineffective arms early and expand more promising ones. Definitely challenges though, right? Statistical complexity is probably the biggest one. It's for an average clinician who is not a statistician, these trials are very hard to understand. These designs require sophisticated statistical methods, careful planning to conform for multiple testing and maintain appropriate power. The regulatory pathways can also be complex, I would imagine. There are interpretation challenges, right? When you have multiple interim analysis and adaptive modifications, it can be harder to interpret results and apply them to clinical practice. What do you do when the clinical trial design changes midway through? And I mentioned that, obviously the regulatory acceptance challenges, which make these trials harder to run, and practical implications can be challenging. These trials require more sophisticated infrastructure, real-time data management. So, you have to be a certain level of capability. You have to have a certain level of capability at your center to be able to participate in these trials. And I think there are lots of cool examples in the GU oncology, like STAMPEDE, and a lot of biomarker trials trying to first test HRR positive, or even like in Amplitude, they tested BRCA positive first and then moved to the testing of the entire population. So I think these designs represent the future of clinical trials, especially as we move towards more personalized biomarker driven therapy. But we need to be thoughtful about how we design, conduct, and interpret them, and educate community on how to think through the results of these trials with complex statistical designs.
Very good points. I mean, I think we would all agree that trial design has gotten a lot better and is going to continue to adapt as we kind of go into the future. I think the field has done a really good job from where we were in the 80s to where we are now in terms of the level of evidence that's required to change practice. But I wonder if that pendulum needs to swing back a little bit more towards the midline as we're seeing more and more drugs hit the market and we're seeing drugs with much more significant impact on survival. And so it begs the question, how do you interpret trials that might have regulatory approval with surrogate endpoints? Obviously overall survival is what we wish we got on every trial, but we can't always delay things that long, particularly in hormone sensitive prostate cancer, where life expectancy might be a little bit longer. So how do you interpret those results and how does that affect your practice?
Maybe I can start with the definition of surrogate endpoints, the way I think about them. So with surrogate endpoint, these are measurable outcomes that we hope that predict clinical benefit. Things like progression-free survival, pathologic complete responses, or biomarker changes, rather than the outcomes that patients may ultimately care about, like survival or quality of life. The key principle is that surrogate endpoints are not automatically equivalent to clinical benefit. They are predictive markers that we hope correlate with what matters to the patient, but the correlation isn't guaranteed. And when I'm evaluating a trial with surrogate endpoints, I ask several questions. First, how well validated is this surrogate endpoint? This is crucial, and honestly, most surrogate endpoints have limited validation. For example, in prostate cancer, radiographic progression-free survival has shown reasonable correlation with clinical benefit in several landmark trials, but it's not a perfectly validated surrogate. We have seen trials where PFS improvement didn't fully translate into OS benefits, and we have seen trials where RPFS gives us meaningful information. It's not a guarantee of the clinical outcomes patients ultimately care about. Perhaps let's think of a relevant example. Let's think about darolutamide recent approval for mHSPC, which is based on primarily RPFS data from ARANOT. We saw that impressive 46% reduction in progression risk, but overall survival benefit wasn't statistically significant. Granted that the data is still immature, this is the perfect example of why we need to be thoughtful about surrogate endpoints. RPFS benefit was substantial and, in my opinion, clinically meaningful, but we're still waiting for more mature survival data. But if you put this in the context of what other endpoints are available other than RPFS, you know, the ARANOT data suddenly start to shine. For example, now we also have data for health-related quality of life. So now you have to start putting in context the not only the strength of the surrogate endpoint, but all the other patient-relevant, clinically meaningful endpoints like health-related quality of life. And then you can also look at the safety and tolerability of the drug. You know, again, let's put in context of darolutamide. While with darolutamide, we only have RPFS data, we have seen meaningful improvement in quality of life. We have seen meaningful improvement or a meaningful toxicity profile. In that context, you know, RPFS is enough for making some practice adjustments or using darolutamide in patients. The situation may be different in other situations where we don't have other meaningful endpoints. One thing is obviously the strength of the, you know, the validation of the surrogate endpoint, magnitude of the effect, safety and tolerability implications, does the biology make sense? So all of these things sort of come together on how I interpret surrogate endpoints. So practically, how do I handle this with patients? I try to be transparent about what we know and what we don't know. I explain that the drug has shown benefit on important measures of disease control, but we're still waiting on overall survival and long-term outcomes. I discuss the magnitude of benefit, side effects profile. For many of my patients, delaying disease progression is meaningful, even if you don't have survival data yet. Maintaining functional status, avoiding symptoms, buying time can be valuable goals. I was just, last Monday, I was with a patient. What he cared most about was quality of life. He was absolutely clear that I don't care if I live 1 or 2 years longer, but, you know, give me the best treatment. But my major priority is maintaining and preserving quality of life. So I think the interpretation is sort of in context of a patient's situation.
Yeah, you know, people are such individuals, and the people that we see in our clinics are not necessarily the same people that are going to enroll in clinical trials. So along those lines of thinking, do you think that we're going to potentially at some point rely more on real world data in the future? And I guess I'd love to hear if you think that we might ever rely on real world data as a substitute for a randomized trial.
I absolutely think we'll rely more heavily on real-world data in future. And in fact, we're already seeing this trend accelerate. But whether it can truly substitute randomized trials is a very nuanced question. So let's talk about where real-world data excels. First, it captures the patients we actually treat. Clinical trials have strict inclusion-exclusion criteria that often don't reflect our real-world patient population. The question I'm always asking is, how does this trial's data apply to the patient sitting in front of me? If the trial doesn't reflect the kind of patient that is sitting in front of me, even it has OS, if the trial showed OS benefit, it got regulatory approval, it's sort of less meaningful, right? I still have to prioritize what my patient looks like and what my patient actually benefits would benefit if patient gets the drug. Second, the real world data sets excel where they provide us long-term efficacy and effectiveness data. We can follow patients for years and capture real adverse events or long-term outcomes that might not be apparent in a controlled environment or in a clinical trial with limited follow-up. I think it's incredibly valuable for comparative effectiveness research. We can't run all the trials. The trials are expensive, really expensive, and we are not going to have head-to-head trials like comparing different RPs in MHSPC or even, you know, across other GU diseases. So here, you know, for comparative effectiveness, real-world data can help us understand relative effectiveness, tolerability, discontinuation patterns in clinical practice. You know, having said that, real-world data has significant limitations. Selection bias is the biggest challenge when we grab patients to be involved in a real-world study from electronic health record data. Real-world treatment decisions aren't random. They're based on patient characteristics, physician preferences, and all the other factors that can confound our ability to determine true treatment effect. The sickest patients might get one treatment, while healthier patients get another, making it very difficult to make fair comparison outcomes. Confounding by indication is related. When we see different outcomes between treatments in real-world data, it's often because the patient receiving those treatments are fundamentally different to begin with. And a real big issue is data quality and completeness. How do we accurately assess progression-free survival in real-world life? Or, you know, and when we are looking retrospectively, it's really hard to guess robust progression outcomes in oncology just looking retrospectively. You know, I used to feel that this is almost impossible, but I think with one of the things that, you know, I work very closely is using large language models. And one of the more promising applications of large language models in sort of real world research spaces, prospective data collection for clinical outcomes using the help of these LLMs. What we're piloting at Mayo Clinic is, as we see patients in the clinic, we have these language model-based AI solutions which automatically extract the data from clinician outcomes, clinician notes, and, you know, radiology reports, and populate red cap and where a human can, you know, verify that. And they have ability to ask the question with the, you know, treating clinician the same day, where, you know, if they have confusion of if the LLM evaluation doesn't make sense. So I think we are moving in the direction where we can have more robust outcome assessment using AI-assisted methods. And once we have more robust data, this concept of emulated trials or target trials can be applied more and more. Because if we have data that we can trust, then we can use these techniques to match patients better across different drugs and emulate clinical trials using real-world data.
Yeah, that's really informative. I think we can all agree trials are going to change, and what changes practice is going to change. I want to thank you, Dr. Riaz, for joining us today. I think you did a great job going over the landscape of ARPIs in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Really good discussion about trial design and how to interpret endpoints. I think that would be, you know, it's going to be a really important part of how we look at new medications going forward. I want to thank Dr. Morgans for co-hosting this with us today. And then I want to thank everybody for tuning in on this webcast. And we look forward to seeing you for the next webcast. Thank you all.